Well, this morning we come to the final in this five-part series, seeking to grapple with some of the basic pew attitudes toward American Protestantism, or at least expressed in modern Protestantism, that emerged, at least we can identify traits of this in the 19th century, but which also, even to the day, today have considerable bearing on the American religious scene. And we come today, after looking at the gospel of wealth and the social gospel, taking a quick trip through revivalism, and looking yesterday at new thought techniques and ideas, to today's concern, which is the crusading spirit that is to be found in American Protestantism. And looking at the crusading spirit, we can trace this through much of our history. It was expressed, I think, very cogently in 1835 by Lyman Beecher, who was the father of perhaps the 19th century's greatest American preacher, Henry Ward Beecher. Lyman Beecher in 1835 assumed the presidency of Lane Theological Seminary in Cincinnati. And he prepared for the Congregational Home Missionary Society, the American Home Missionary Society as it was called at that time, a missionary tract. Which was given the name Plea for the West. And in this Plea for the West, what Lyman Beecher is seeking to do is to lay out a justification as to why there ought to be a congregationally oriented seminary on the American frontier. And Lyman Beecher justified it in these words: "The West is destined to be the great central power of the nation, and under heaven must affect powerfully the cause of free institutions and the liberty of the world." That is, he saw that the future of the American nation was going to be settled in the Midwest. Therefore, from his paternalistic point of view, it was absolutely essential that Yankee religion be quickly planted in the Great West. And he says it's going to affect powerfully not only the nation, but the liberty of the world. And what he had in mind here was that if the Congregationalists don't come out and establish a culture in this area, it will be done by the Roman Catholics. And they are the ones which do not powerfully affect the liberty of the world on the positive side. So that in 1835, when there are yet relatively few Roman Catholics in the Ohio Mississippi Valley, Beecher was very sensitive to the powerful threat they could be to the Yankee culture that had been developed in New England, which he thought ought to prevail across the entire nation. 50 years later, in 1885, just at the time that there develops the new immigration to this country, which is primarily Roman Catholic and is primarily Slavic rather than Nordic, a pastor in Cheyenne, Wyoming, writes another missionary tract. This one is entitled Our Country, and the writer is Josiah Strong. And he says that the future of mankind, now he doesn't settle with America at all, the future of mankind depends upon the Anglo-Saxons. And this is so because the Anglo-Saxons, and by Anglo-Saxon he meant now the stock that had resulted from the commingling of the various peoples who had come to America. And up to 1885, they were still dominantly the Northern European.
But not the blacks.
But not the, oh no, they're not included in this at all. They're not in this, not in Cheyenne. Neither is the Indian. Though he does say some things about the Indians. And he says that the Anglo-Saxons have developed the two divine concepts of civil liberty and pure spiritual Christianity. And since in America these have been perfected, it is upon the American Protestant community that the destiny of man depends. Now I am laying this groundwork to suggest that here we are seeing evidences of a crusading spirit. That in America has been then perfected God's weapon for spiritual and civil righteousness. Now, I would like to look at several examples as to how this manifested itself, than in the latter part of the 19th and the early part of the 20th centuries. And the first one I will bring to your attention is the Spanish-American War. Now, I cannot assert that the Christian community actively sought this war. That was sought more in a public vein by the Hearst and Pulitzer papers. The church press did not call for this war, and in fact spoke out against the development of such a war. But the papers were able to create a climate of hysteria with the sinking of the USS Maine in the Havana Harbor. And war then did come. But where we see the crusading element is not in the war hawks, but rather the crusading element comes to the fore after the war has been concluded. And what does now America do with the far-flung Spanish possessions that now come under American tutelage? And one of the expressors of this is the President of the United States, William McKinley, a Methodist, and from the reading that I have done, he took his Methodism very seriously. And McKinley then was tortured about what to do with the possibility of America becoming a colonial power. Now, last hour it was brought out that America never really did become a significant political colonial power. Economic, yes, but not political. All right, here's McKinley's faced with the realities of a political. What do we do with it? Do we enter this or do we not? But he comes up with this crusading idea, which he states in an address to clergymen after he had decided that the American peace commissioners should demand the Philippine Islands in the peace settlement with Spain. McKinley states, "I walk the floor of the White House night after night until midnight. And I'm not ashamed to tell you, gentlemen, that I went down on my knees and prayed Almighty God for light and guidance more than one night. And one night it came to me this way. I don't know how it was, but it came. There was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them, and by God's grace to do the best we could by them. And then I went to bed and went to sleep and slept soundly." Now here then I'm suggesting is a bit of a crusading element in the American Protestant community. Now the irony of the whole thing is that of all of the Asian nations, this was the only one that could have been said to have been Christianized. Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
But it was Roman Catholic. So here this devout Methodist says, we must take them, educate them, civilize, and Christianize them. But there is a reluctance in this. And the only reason that he can give to become involved now in a political colonization scheme is a religious one, that we must then develop not only civilization, but it must be a Christian civilization. Others were not quite so hesitant as to what the possibilities of the Philippines provided America, and one of them was Senator Elbert J. Beveridge, and his approach to it was to use biblical imagery. Now here is a political crusader, but he also bases it upon some religious convictions. And then he goes like this: "It is the destiny that the world shall be rescued from its natural wilderness and from savage men. Civilization is no less an evolution than the changing forms of animal and vegetable life." A bit of pop Darwinism coming in here. See, Darwin made really no impact on this country until the late 1860s and 70s. Origin of Species, published in England in 1859, was ignored here in America during the Civil War decade. Then it came on later. Now here Beveridge is picking this up, in a rather pop way. "Surely and steadily the reign of law, which is the very spirit of liberty, takes the place of arbitrary caprice. Surely and steadily the methods of social order are bringing the whole earth under their subjugation. And to deny that this is right is to deny that civilization should increase. In this great work, the American people must have their part. They are fitted for the work as no people have ever been fitted, and their work lies before them. And then with regard to the Philippines in particular, he states, when circumstance has raised our flag above them. Now, you see, we did not seek them. Circumstance has raised our flag above them. We dare not turn these misguided children, remember now, there's considerable Roman Catholicism here, over to destruction by themselves or spoilation by others, and then make answer when the God of nations requires them at our hands. Am I my brother's keeper? Using another biblical analogy, he becomes even more religiously oriented. We will not renounce our part in the mission of the race, trustees under God of the civilization of the world. Here we get those phraseologies that we looked at last Monday with Andrew Carnegie, with the concept that of stewardship, trusteeship, these fine English words that are still very much part of the English way of life, the trusts that are everywhere. Under God, it is our duty then to civilize and advance the world and also spiritualize it, and by that he means to Protestantize it. He has marked the American people as his chosen nation to finally lead in the regeneration of the world. Again, those imageries that Carnegie could use to develop natural resources. This is the divine mission of America. The judgment of the master is upon us. And now he comes back to that same parable that Carnegie used. Ye have been faithful over a few things. I will make you ruler over many things. Exercise then your trusteeship.
Did he make that in a Senate speech? Or yes. Was he talking to a church group?
No, it's Senate speech.
It's part of his political...
This is political rhetoric.
Yeah, rhetoric.
This is his political rhetoric at the time. This is... Now remember, we're talking here about 1900... The number of American people who were actually identified with institutional religion is not very large. But we're going to come back to a few moments, because I'm going to suggest that one of the greatest crusades of American Protestantism is the Sunday school. That it primarily is not a nurturing element as we think of it in Lutheranism, but the Sunday school has been in most Protestant denominations a crusade. And at this time, what went on in Sunday school was the rote memorization of large passages of Scripture. So there may have indeed been a considerable larger scriptural knowledge by those people than there are today, when twice as many people really identify with institutional Christianity. But it is a type of literature that can legitimately be quoted and can be acceptable. But there was a theologian in the group, in another senator by the name of George F. Hoar, H-O-A-R, who also told his colleagues in the Senate, in response to Beveridge's idea of our trusteeship, and this is the part that Hoar quotes, "The devil taketh him up into an extremely high mountain and showeth him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them, and saith unto him, all these things will be thine if thou wilt fall down and worship me." Now I use this as a transition to suggest that imperialism was not the American mindset in 1900. That we backed off of this. That this surge here into the Philippines was not the norm. It was the exception. But the crusading element there of a religious trusteeship, a religious duty, is there. And it works for the moment, even though basically we pull back from it. Well then, about 20 years later, this comes up again with regard to World War I. And this time we have another very devout man in the White House, son of a Presbyterian minister, himself president of a Presbyterian college, university at Princeton, and the personage of Woodrow Wilson. Now, Wilson, unlike McKinley, had a worldview and saw that America ought to be involved in the world from the point of view of principle. So there's quite a difference. But Wilson did not want to become involved in a war. And he was elected to his second term by a catchy slogan for which he himself felt no responsibility and deplored, "He kept us out of the war." And of course he won the presidency the first time around, not by any majority, by any means, but simply by a plurality because of a divided Republican Party. So he comes in. Now, in 1917, he is finally forced by principle to ask for a declaration of war. He had lined out the principles on which America would keep out. It was up to the Germans if they were going to force the American hand. The Germans did force the American hand. They decided they would torpedo all shipping on the Atlantic. And that seemed to be the breaking point. So Wilson then goes before Congress, and he gives this kind of a religious crusading spirit. "We shall fight for the things which we have always carried nearest our hearts, for democracy, for the right of those who submit to authority to have a voice in their own governments, for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right by such a concert of free peoples as shall bring peace and safety to all nations, and make the world itself at last free." Now, Wilson here is not really using biblical imagery. He's not using parables. He's simply building on American democracy. But the Protestants and the Roman Catholics picked up this cause, this holy war of the 20th century, and turned biblical phraseology toward it. But sometimes they weren't just biblical, they were simply flamboyant. And one of the molders, or perhaps one could say he really wasn't so much a molder as he was an expresser of a certain element of American opinion at that time, was the most popular revivalist during the First World War era, Billy Sunday. And Billy Sunday thrived on anti-German stances. As I mentioned to you when we looked at revivalism, he made this comment: "If you turn hell upside down, you will find 'Made in Germany' stamped on the bottom." Well, now, in January of 1918, in the midst of the American participation of the war, Billy Sunday was invited to open the day's proceedings of the U.S. House of Representatives with a prayer. Here is his prayer: "Thou knowest, O Lord, that no nation so infamous, vile, greedy, sensuous, bloodthirsty ever disgraced the pages of history. Make bare thy mighty arm, O Lord, and smite the hungry, wolfish Hun, whose fangs drip with blood, and we will forever raise our voice to thy praise." Now, here is creating an environment. Here is popular pew piety entering the scene of a crusade in the midst of war. Lyman Abbott, who was Henry Ward Beecher's successor at Plymouth Church in Brooklyn, made this comment in a book entitled The 20th Century Crusade, and he actually uses the term, just as when you come down to the 1950s, when Dwight Eisenhower was to write his history of the war, he also uses the term crusade. Now, Lyman Abbott says, "A crusade to make this world a home in which God's children can live in peace and safety is more Christian than a crusade to recover from pagans the tomb in which the body of Christ was buried." He doesn't really give it all the religious connotations. He was, like Henry Ward Beecher, forever trying to raise the sights of the American Protestant community. But, like Henry Ward Beecher, had the ability never to go beyond one's tolerance, his audience's tolerance, so lifted slowly and surely. But the major Roman Catholic spokesman in the country was more willing to throw in his lot. Cardinal Gibbons of Baltimore made this statement in April of 1917. The primary duty, and of course you'd expect a Roman Catholic to begin using terms like this, the primary duty of a citizen is loyalty to country. This loyalty is manifested more by acts than by words, by solemn service rather than by empty declaration. It is exhibited by an absolute and unreserved obedience to his country's call. Now there is an uncritical. There is Cardinal Gibbons, 1917, in America. Now take that 25 years later, and you'll see what the German bishops were saying with regard to Adolf Hitler. It is duty to the fatherland. But here you have it, the Americans using this in 1917, and the cardinal unhesitatingly stating it. Even though this very same cardinal had gone in to President Wilson to offer the support of the Roman Catholic Church to the First World War, and Wilson, fine Presbyterian minister's son that he was, wouldn't even lift up his face from the documents he was reading at his desk in the Oval Office. Wouldn't even acknowledge that the cardinal was in his room. But yet Gibbons could still come forth with this kind of support for a crusade, then, that has been identified. The Northern Baptist Convention in 1917 passed this resolution, which was typical of the many denominational resolutions. Whereas our country is at war in defense of humanity, liberty, and democracy, we do solemnly pledge to the President and Government of the United States our wholehearted allegiance and support, and dedicate ourselves to our just and righteous cause. Now, this is the Baptist group in 1917. Well, there is then a change that occurs, I think at least a subtle one, whereas we were not an imperialistic nation looking for a political domain, yet we would not shun the fight, either in the Spanish-American War or in the First World War. And once we had entered the conflict, then the Protestant community quickly came to its support and saw in it then a crusade. Later, some of you may want to raise questions about comments on World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. See what happened later in the 20th century. But here is a tenor then of a crusading spirit that the churches jump on in that we see here at the turn of the century. Another form of crusade, and there are several of these that I want to at least briefly allude to this hour, another one has to do with foreign missions. It was in the latter part of the 19th century that we became more actively involved in what was then identified as foreign missions. And basically this was due to the fact because of the political situations in countries around the world that brought about the greater imposition of Western powers. And this then allowed for the entrance of Christian missionaries in far greater numbers. But the person who becomes the great stimulus to foreign missions in this country is Dwight L. Moody. I am making a suggestion that in nearly every venture in late 19th century Protestant activity, the figure Dwight L. Moody stands at very near the top. He was not only then the revivalist conducting his great city campaigns, but he was active in most every Protestant program. And in foreign missions, it came as a result of a conference. And this is one thing that I've always admired in Moody, though he was a conservative evangelical himself, if we can use some of our present terms to read back on him. And that was the way he conducted himself when addressing the thousands of people in the auditoriums. Every summer he ran a summer school at his home in Northfield, Massachusetts, to which he invited individuals of a far different religious temperament. And at one of these, in 1886, there developed, out of a presentation on the mission challenge of the world, this theme: all should go and go to all. And out of this came the student volunteer movement, which probably became the greatest contribution that the American Protestant community made to church use in the 19th century. The student volunteer movement, which then took on this somewhat naive theme, the evangelization of the world in this generation. The evangelization of the world in this generation. Now, I'm suggesting that this also falls within the category of a crusade. That within a 20-year period, the young people of America can go forth and convert the world. Now that the political situation is such that they can gain admittance to many countries, go forth and do this. But I'd also like to point out that the missionaries were not imperialists at all. Though the press at home, which drummed up financial support for them, was oftentimes quite imperialistic. But the missionaries themselves were not. And it was the missionaries who took the lead, and we've talked about this earlier in the week, of actually establishing the indigenous churches. The men on the field often encouraged this sort of thing. So there seemed to be quite a discrepancy between the missionary on the field and the boards back home. And you had the same thing, and when I studied Protestantism in Frontier Montana, there was a tremendous tension there between the pastors out on the Intermountain West and the mission boards back east, who simply couldn't understand what they were doing and why they were doing what they were doing in the far west. So there seems to have been quite a discrepancy between the New York offices and the missionaries, whether they were in Africa or they were in Montana. There was quite a discrepancy there. So they were not the imperially minded, but back home it was understood quite imperialistically.
Would you comment on how that took shape? What form did that student volunteer movement evolve? How did it evolve?
It involved oftentimes in rather close association with the YMCA, where you already had an organizational structure, or where people would simply commit themselves to what were essentially pan-denominational societies who would raise the funds, and you would take on a term and then you would go. They were not really under denominational control this well initially. Then came your denominational missions. But Moody just didn't operate in denominational frameworks. He operated in the youthful enthusiasm that we can go out and do this, I should say. So in a general, that it seems to me that's how it got its start.
Did they go with backing, though, financial or otherwise, or did they have to, were they like faith missions that found their own support?
Moody developed a support system for this quickly.
Student volunteer movement?
I'm not sure exactly on that one how that initially was financed, but they were quickly developed at about the same time then support systems for these various causes, so that they were not left. I mean they may have gone initially, I'm not sure, but they were not left without support. But it was not often in some of these instances denominational support.
Well, that was a question I was aiming at. I mean, there was a stimulus here, and there was motivation and recruitment. But beyond the commitment to go, was there a structure to select fields and guide them into fields, or did they tie into normal denominational mission bodies?
I'm not sure initially whether they did or not, but there was the genius of Moody that he was never without funds for any project that he pursued. And when Moody went after it, after money, he went after it like our colleges do now, when they seek capital gifts. Moody always went after the initial contributors. In financial circles, Moody's friends in Chicago were the McCormicks, the Fields, the Swifts. And he raised money that way. But there's another side of that that Mark Twain picked up in that novel that I referred to the other day called The Gilded Age, A Tale for Today. And I think the kind of support system that eventually emerges, particularly within denominational circles, is like this one that Twain refers to in his own little satirical way. He has a senator, and he calls him Senator Dilworthy, his play on words. Senator Dilworthy, and Twain says this about Senator Dilworthy, that he would never miss a Women's Mission Society meeting when he was out on the hustlings looking for votes. Never miss that. Because this became the vehicle by which the denomination so largely supported their own program. And here is Senator Dilworthy. His comment about him as Twain reads it. He graced the sewing circles of the ladies with his presence, and even took a needle now and then and made a stitch or two upon a calico shirt for some poor Bibleless pagan of the South Seas. And this act enchanted the ladies, who regarded the garments thus honored as in a manner sanctified. I'm suggesting that the denominations worked up their own support systems. Moody developed his, which were not based on the calico shirts, but upon the large gifts of individuals. Now, exactly historically how they've met, I'm not sure.
Many of those denominational women's organizations were initially called Women's Missionary Society.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Women's Missionary Society.
To raise money and material support for these things. Clothing for foreign missions.
But I'm suggesting here that it seems to me that there was at least a little discrepancy between the sort of crusading attitude that there was here at home and that you found in many of the missionaries themselves. Now, they were stuck by the fact that they often did not know how to proclaim the message except in Western liturgical dress. You know, that may have been, but they were not seeking really to establish an American empire abroad. So a kind of an idea at home that was kind of thought what it was thought to be.
They weren't peddling the American way of life, but people at home thought they were.
Yeah, or thought they ought to be.
Thought they ought to be, yeah.
But they may indeed been presenting Christianity in a very American framework. Like the British in India built some beautiful Norman churches, you know, initially. That type of thing.
The Germans in Tanzania.
No, that kind of thing. There's a discrepancy there, I think. Ralph?
Did any of them follow the patterns of the European British or German with sending society here? You mentioned that the denomination went to it, all right, and these other groups. Were you just more of an odd hope group? What did they follow? What pattern did they follow?
Well, I think we'll discover that, and this is a theme that Winthrop Hudson makes, that there is very little in American religion that is not imitation of prior European patterns, particularly English patterns. And of course, by this time, latter part of the 19th century, you already have very established European patterns. And so my reaction to that, without looking in detail, would be that, oh no, they would have followed, most likely, an English pattern.
And cooperated with them.
And that type of thing, yeah. Yeah, they were, we talk about the creative genius of American religion. There's very little of it that is creative. It is mostly adoption and adaptation of European patterns. Now, more recently, we have seen some American groups that are now being exported to England and to the continent. But we have been a very borrowing nation in terms of our religion. A very borrowing nation type of thing. Well, that is another form of crusading. But again, I'm suggesting it's a bit of a mixed bag. Then another one that I put in, and I'm not sure you all will go with me on this one, and if you don't, I certainly invite you to respond. And that is, I'm suggesting that the Sunday school is another form of crusade. And I'm suggesting this because it seemed to me that the Sunday school developed in this nation as a vehicle to impose upon our own people a particular pattern. Now, and I get this because the Sunday schools were to replace the revival in many instances. The Sunday schools developed the technique, each one win one. And I think we're all aware of Sunday schools that still operate somewhat that way today. There's one just down the block from where we live in Rock Island, four or five blocks, that has a campaign, at least they used to have when they were located in another part of town, a campaign where there was an attendance chart in the front of the church. And each child then had some kind of an animal form, a sheep. So there was his name. And then if he were present that day, there would be a sheep placed next to his name. If he brought a guest, it was a white sheep. But if he came alone, it was a black sheep. Now, what kind of sheep are you today? Are you a white sheep or are you a black sheep? Each one win one. Crusade to gather in people. Now that perhaps is a little more blatant than some other Sunday schools, and the major one in our community is the Four Square Gospel Temple, which operates a fleet, I think it's 22 school buses. 22 school buses on Sunday morning that cover the Quad City area. Or we have another one, the Westside Assembly of God, which is supposedly one of the fastest growing congregations in America. And they send out a whole fleet of buses, and then on those buses we'll have a banana split that goes from one end of the bus to the other, so the kids can have breakfast as they go to Sunday school, that type of thing, or the world's longest hot dog or something like that. All kinds of trickeries and techniques. Each one, win one. This is not talking about nurture. This is talking about getting them in and then imposing upon them. And then to use somewhat that biblical phraseology to their own benefit, a little child shall lead them. And if they get the kids there, that means they'll likely get the parents there for the Christmas program. And then the door is open. And then other reasons for getting the parents, and then maybe this is the way you'll not only increase your congregation, but you will then extend a certain point of view widely through the community. Also, these Sunday schools, not so much now, I think, but as in former times, the Sunday schools, like a revival, built up to a particular high point, which was called Decision Day. And it would be difficult, I imagine, psychologically, for a child not to make the right decision on Decision Day. Would that be right, Paul? This would all be carefully lined out and carefully prepared.
Program,
and that's what they do with these kids. And Decision Day was a big day in Sunday school. Then to sort of cement this whole thing together, there was developed in the 1872, the Uniform Lesson Plan, so that each grade, each age level in the Sunday school would be studying the same scriptural text. And that would be studied by every Sunday school participating in the program. So that in a given community, on one Sunday, all of the Sunday school classes might indeed be studying the same passage. Uniform lesson plan. And then, to go along with that, they developed Saturday afternoon teaching institutes so that all the teachers from all of the Protestant churches could come and review the same lesson.
and receive the same study aid. Another way then to impose a singular interpretation on an entire community of all age levels. The uniform lesson plan. My little hometown newspaper in Northwest Iowa, still today in the 1970s, 100 years later, publishes every Thursday in the weekly paper the uniform lesson for the next Sunday. This is the form then I'm suggesting of crusading. Now, in my
Myron?
Yeah.
Excuse me. One of the features of that approach, which has continued down, I think, to the present, it was certainly true just 2 years ago, is that they publish quarterly 13 Sunday segments. The denominations would do their own thing, but using the same text. And each of the quarters, one Sunday in 13, had to have a lesson in it on abstinence from alcohol. That was part of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you may still be coming to that.
That's the last crusade we get to.
But one Sunday in 13, year in and year out, I mean, one Sunday, four Sundays a year, had to deal with that issue.
Well, later on, there developed some very serious questions as to whether certain biblical passages were appropriate for certain age levels. And so eventually the uniform lesson plan was changed by 1918 to incorporate a bit of a graded lesson plan, a bit of a compromise, so that there was some attempt then that the passages would be appropriate for the particular age level. So there was some breaking of the pattern. But nonetheless, it was basically this. Now, and again, in doing this study of Montana from the Civil War up to 1920, I noticed that a number of the denominations were very quick on the frontier to establish a Sunday school. Hopefully, that Sunday school, without a great deal of expenditure, might become the foundation for an eventual congregation. But then I also discovered that some other denominations, notably the Lutheran and the Episcopalian, wouldn't do that. Because they, at least in Montana, never saw the Sunday school as really a recruitment agent. They saw it as an internal vehicle for the nurturing of the children of the members. Now, in this line then, you see, I'm suggesting that the Sunday school can hardly be called a crusade. But it's a crusade when it goes out to bring the children and to then impose upon them. So I think generally we have a somewhat different idea of the Sunday school than do many denominations. Yeah, Paul.
Except in the inner city.
Mm-hmm. So there we have done this. Then it's the first step in an entrance into a community.
20 years ago, 50 years ago. Exactly, the youth that's named Sunday school
mm-hmm.
and Vacation Bible School.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vacation Bible Schools also merge now at about the same time. So you get the real development of Sunday schools on a much larger degree. Of course, they've been with us for quite some time. You get Vacation Bible Schools, and then you get thrown into another, I think, crusading element that's closely related, and that is the Chautauqua movement. Coming out of Lake Chautauqua in New York in the 1870s. To which there was also a certain religious flavor, but it was also pop culture.
How about the release time from the public school?
Well, that, as far as I know, is a 20th century phenomenon primarily, and that varies from state to state and from time to time as the Supreme Court wrestles with what is involved here in terms of the church-state relations. Well, do you see valid my suggestion here that in some ways these are crusades and in some ways they're not necessarily crusades?
Mm-hmm.
So much, I mean, it's ambiguous again here as well. Constant ambiguity about this, but there is this general tenor that the crusades present from time to time. Then there is another one which was blatantly a crusade and I think was very unfortunate, and we still live with some of it in this country, but not nearly as much as they do in England, where it's very much to the fore. And that is, with the change in immigration patterns in the 1880s to including more Southern and Eastern Europeans, and also with the rise of ghettos in the industrial cities, there developed an intense economic conflict. And this centers then around Roman Catholicism. And this economic uncertainty leads to a religious umbrella for proclaiming a war on Roman Catholics. And one of the most eloquent expressions of this in the late 19th century developed just 30 miles north of the Quad Cities at the Iowa River town of Clinton, where there was formulated in 1887 the American Protective Association, which was a lodge-like organization for the avowed purpose of reducing the impact of Roman Catholicism on this country. Would love to have seen the immigration quotas established that did come in the 1920s. But in the meantime, make the Roman Catholic servile. And this is expressed in one of the pledges that was taken by one who became a member of the APA. It reads as follows: I hereby declare that I am a firm believer in a deity. I am not a member of the Roman Catholic Church, nor have I any sympathy with Roman Catholicism. That in my opinion, no Roman Catholic should be allowed any part or parcel in the control or occupy any position in our public school. On the contrary, I realize that the institutions of our country are in danger from the machinations of the Church of Rome. I believe that only by the removal of Roman Catholics from offices of trust can justice, right, and true American sentiment, and those are bold-faced words in the creed, justice, right, and true American sentiment, be fully subserved, and that by the concerted and continued efforts of the lovers of American liberty only can such results be consummated and continued. So then here emerges one of those anti-Catholic waves. And this one's not coming out of the East. This is coming out of a little Midwestern river town, 1887. Virulent anti-Catholicism. And it played quite a role for more than a decade in American life, in the Midwest and towards the East. And APA candidates secured a number of local legislatures, local city councils, had a considerable voice in the Iowa legislature, the Minnesota legislature, the Michigan legislature. Came to be quite a political force. It was cut short when it tried to prevent the renomination of William McKinley, who was not considered Protestant enough. And then it fell rather quickly. But it did show that under economic duress, that religion could become a tool to undertake a crusade to stop the flow of the undesirable aliens who were Roman Catholic. This broke out again in a periodical called The Menace, at the time of World War I. The Menace, another anti-Catholic statement. So these crusades against Catholics are not absent in this country, even to the 20th century. In my little hometown, it's only been within the last 10 years when it's become evident that the Catholics will never have the finances to build a school if they've ever elected a Roman Catholic to the school board. Never elect a Catholic to the school board as long as there was any chance whatsoever that the Catholics would build a public school. But now that that's no longer an option, then they're considered fully responsible citizens capable of administering the public school or helping to administer the public school. Another type of crusade. Another one that really caused a little skirmish has left a few blue laws on the books that are now slowly disintegrating, and that is Sabbatarianism. that emerges here at the same time. And this again is a cultural conflict, I think, between the Roman Catholics and German Lutherans, and then the Christians on the other side. It's really Wisconsin and farther east against the rest of the nation, but it's centered around the Continental Sabbath versus the Puritan Sabbath, and the attempt to continue Puritan Sabbath legislation or to prevent its erosion by the Continental Sabbath. And it meets some interesting reading, but it's in the crusading spirit again that you will find these conflicts going on. And as we were just talking up with coffee or the break, that it's only been very recently in Iowa, for example, that you could buy hams or any other beer in a grocery store on Sunday. And those are always.
Or a restaurant.
You know, even get a drink in a restaurant. Even get a drink in a restaurant on Sundays.
Minnesota too, it's the last decade.
Yeah.
That was thing.
Yeah. These are slowly going up.
Still can't do it in Virginia?
Can't do it in North Dakota
either. Yeah, I mean, some of these Sabbatarian
Utah
almost any time probably ideally there. But some of these are still on, and these were campaigns that were carried out. These were crusades, as I'm using the term here. Then the last one that we come to, and is the one that sweeps it all within its feet, and I see our time is just about elapsed, the dinner bell will be ringing soon, is the Prohibition campaign. And the Prohibition campaign simply gathered all other crusades in its own arms, just as the abolition one did earlier in our nation's history. It just sort of brought them all within, and became an example whereby initially, persuasion, persuade the drinker not to drink, persuade the brewer not to brew. When that fails, then to seek political redress. First, in terms of local options, then in terms of state legislation, finally in terms of constitutional amendments. But like so many of these crusades, this crusade was a middle-class crusade. And it was not only led by the religious forces, but it was led also by the business community. Because there were not only the social implications, there were the economic implications. So here, Protestant and Roman Catholic, and in many parts of the country, the Roman Catholics were the most diligent in the early stages of the Prohibition movement. That is when it was primarily moderation, not prohibition. Roman Catholics were often very much behind this as well. That here then we have a locking together of the church going and the non-church going, seeking this moral crusade, which was seen as necessary to be accomplished if everyone was indeed to pursue the middle-class dream. Sobriety was necessary to success. And so in this one, you could have Gospel of Wealth advocates, you could have Walter Rauschenbusch from the Social Gospel, you could have Billy Sunday from the Revivalists, you could have the Crusaders. All across the board you could have the religious leaders as well as the business community on this grand crusade to clean America. So in conclusion then to this series, it seems to me that there has always been a rather widely based, though often ambiguous, crusading spirit. Whether that be an image that we carry across the world, at least from this side of the ocean, or whether it be for internal improvement. There are the Crusades, and we probably aren't even without them today. Though I do not comment here much on the 20th century. I'll leave that to your judgment. Too close.
He's a historian.
He's a historian.
50 years lead time.
It all branches. It's like everything with American religion. It gets more complicated every year.
And the closer you are to it, the more complicated it is.
You don't see it. You don't see the strand so clearly then. Well, any comments or observations before the dinner bell rings?
How do you assess the pros and cons of the free table movement down to this? Just a general observation. The good and the bad, is that?
Well, I think I would start at least a comment by referring to the point of view I was making there at the end, that initially these were concerns that one sought to persuade another. And of course that's so much a part of American religion, where we have this religious freedom, that persuasion is so much at the bottom of it. But I think with many of these crusades, it quickly leaves the persuasive aspect and becomes a legislative. And then I have some problems. It's a little bit like the charismatic movement that has been institutionalized, where it isn't worship unless you speak in tongues. And we talked a little bit about the manipulative aspect of it. When it's no longer then a free expression of the person, but it becomes a part of the necessary conformity to the group to really be part of the group. It seems like in many of the crusades this has happened. It's lost the voluntary. Then I begin to see negatives.
Myron, if I were to take the risk of looking at candidates for crusade in the current scene in America, I think I would lift up the World Hunger effort, which cuts across all the denominations, liberal and conservative.
Secular as well as religious.
Pardon?
And secular as well as religious.
To some extent, although I think it's being carried, once the headlines go away, carried mainly by the religious community, I think. And trying to get at both education or changing people's minds about what are the root causes of hunger, and at action, which means primarily public policy, legislation, spread for the world, that kind of effort, and change your own lifestyle. That kind of action response. To behave differently yourself as a consumer, but also as a citizen, try to change policy. I think that comes the closest currently to one that sweeps across all the religious communities, particularly the Protestant community. The Catholics somewhat less so, but they're in it too. And it has one phenomenon of the Crusade, which I think the foreign missionary efforts had, raising money separately for that purpose. Mm-hmm. All the denominations have special hunger appeals that are outside the regular benevolent budget. Now that won't last forever, I don't think. But for the present, that still continues. Mm-hmm. I think that approximates the Crusade in today's system. At least I can't think of another candidate that would have that much going for it.
Mm-hmm. So at least it's a positive.
Well, I would say it's positive, yeah. But there are some who raise questions about why hunger should get special fund appeal. Mm-hmm. Why not this or that? You know, and that's a legitimate question to raise. But it's the in thing today in the churches, I guess.